I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The Halliburton Company, under scrutiny for its billing practices, has said it will suspend charges for $140 million worth of food services for U.S. troops in Iraq and Kuwait, while accountants pore over invoices to judge their accuracy. Earlier this month, the Pentagon charged Halliburton's subsidiary, Kellogg Brown and Root, with billing for nearly 4 million meals that were never served. KBR officials deny any wrongdoing, saying their Saudi subcontractor invoiced projected meals instead of actual meals. Well, today's news comes as Halliburton faces possible congressional hearings and even more scrutiny. Jackie Spinner is a reporter for The Washington Post. And Jackie, we noted KBR uses these projected headcounts to bill for meals. How does that work?
This is not an uncommon way for the Defense Department to try to figure out how many people are coming for dinner. They look at the troop rotations, who's in the area, who might be coming to dinner, and they come up with an estimated headcount, and that's what Halliburton or KBR uses to do food preparation.
Well, how is it that nearly 4 million troops didn't show up for dinner?
I think that's the question that the Pentagon has posed to Halliburton, and Halliburton is now trying to respond to. They say that it is, you know, it's simply extremely difficult to figure out how many people are going to be at any given facility. And keep in mind, we're not talking about 4 million meals at one facility in particular. We're talking about meals served over 54-some dining facilities, both in Iraq and Kuwait.
Mm. Well, this isn't the first time Halliburton has been accused of overcharging in Iraq, and there are other charges as well, one of possible kickbacks.
Yes, that's correct. Halliburton has agreed to temporarily refund the government about $6 million to cover possible overcharges by a Kuwaiti company that may have paid kickbacks to one or two KBR employees. They've also been accused of overcharging for fuel, and that amount is at least $61 million, and that's to deliver fuel into Iraq.
Tell us about the political aspects of today's announcements in particular.
Well, I wouldn't want to be Halliburton's public relations today. I mean, I wouldn't have wanted to be their public relations for the last few months. They've been dealing with this since last October. You know, obviously, Vice President Cheney's connection to the company is fueling the political controversy.
He was Halliburton chief from 95 to 2000.
Right, before he became Bush's running mate. And, you know, when you look at where the criticism is coming from Congress, it's coming from senior Democrats. We haven't heard anything from the Republicans. Although if the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee decides to hold a hearing on this, that would be pretty significant, because the Democrats have been trying to get the Republicans to pay attention to this issue in an official manner, and up to this point they have not.
And there are some reports, Jackie, that in fact the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee will take up hearings as early as March to take a closer look at Halliburton spending. And as you well know, last week a panel heard testimony from a KBR whistleblower who said there was a corporate culture that encouraged them to overcharge.
That's correct. The Senate Democrats had Henry Bunting, and he's the KBR employee that you mentioned, come before the panel, and he did describe this corporate culture in which they were encouraged not to seek competitive bidding, and this is not uncommon, this sort of culture that's created by the system in which the military uses these sorts of government contracts, these cost-plus contracts.
And cost-plus contracts, they are paid for their fees, but they're also paid a percentage above their expenses, so some would say that encourages them to inflate the expenses.
There's certainly no incentive for companies to keep their costs down.
Jackie Spinner, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Jackie Spinner, reporter for The Washington Post.
In Iraq, an interim constitution is supposed to take effect by the end of this month, but critical questions remain about that charter. Paul Bremer, the U.S. Administrator for Iraq, said yesterday that though the current draft of the Constitution would make Islam the state religion and a source of inspiration for law, it would not make Islamic or Sharia law the principal basis for legislation. Now, Iraqi women's groups in particular have expressed fear for their rights if a rigid Islamic code were adopted as law. Asked what he would do if Iraqi leaders did write Sharia law into the Constitution, Bremer replied, "It can't be law until I sign it."
Well, the United Nations is expected to state its opinion this week on the possibility of holding elections in Iraq by the June 30th deadline. U.S. officials have already said they would prefer an interim government selected by caucuses, with national elections delayed for a year. A leading Shia cleric is calling for immediate direct elections, but U.S. administrators say Iraqi voters can't be registered in time. And yet, one American official in the Iraqi province of Dikar has been conducting direct elections. Tobin Bradley, political advisor for the Coalition Provisional Authority, has been setting up these elections. And Tobin, tell us, how did you register voters?
Well, there's a system already in place, and that's the Oil for Food Program ration card system. Those ration cards, we estimate are about 95% of the population has them, and we use those. It's pretty hard to fake, and just about every family has one.
Anthony Shadid in the Washington Post writes about some of your elections, and they just sound incredible. You literally are pointing off police where to stand and showing the candidates that the box is empty before you yell out, "Let's go." And to illustrate further what you came across, apparently there was one man who wanted to be a candidate, but he had a genetic condition that made him look like an 8-year-old boy. And you used the story of actor Gary Coleman's candidacy for the governorship in California to illustrate, or at least in part, discrimination?
That's true. There was a list of people on it that the political parties in the local area refused to, for various reasons. They said because they were Baathists and everything else. And so I went through the list and I said, what is this person's problem? And sure enough, a young looking boy walked in the room, which in fact he was 36 years old, said, "Why are you refusing me? You're refusing me." They say because I'm short. And I just looked at them and I said, "You're refusing this guy because he's short?" They said, "Yes, we thought he could. We wanted our representatives to be able to represent us in front of anyone, and we just thought because he was short, he wouldn't be appropriate." And I just looked at them and I said, this sounds a lot like discrimination, guys. I don't know if you heard about our elections in California, but we have a governor there. His name is Arnold Schwarzenegger. I don't know if you know him." They all chuckled. And they said, "Sure, we know him." And I said, "Well, there was also a candidate in that same governor race named Gary Coleman, and he was an actor as well. But he wasn't a big man. He was a small man. And while he didn't win the election, he certainly had the right to run. Now, let the people decide. In California, they chose the big man. But in this town, they might choose something different." And they nodded their heads, and sure enough, he garnered almost 200 votes.
Well, what were the results? There was a fear that Baathists, you know, from Saddam Hussein's party or hardline Islamists would run and win in these elections. What's happened?
What we found, actually, is that until now, we've seen technocrats win. People are not looking for people who are going to pray for them. They want people who are going to be able to provide services. They want water. They want schools. They want health services. So they're electing doctors, teachers, engineers. These are the kinds of people that they're electing.
I'm wondering, Tobin, you are 29 years old and here on the front lines of this, you know, potential democracy in the making. Is there a moment that stands out for you, or just your thoughts on being there?
You know, I'm amazed to be able to be a part of this. I don't think that I've never had an experience like this, and I don't think that I ever will have another experience like this. I just never expected to go to a country that was is so broken. It is the people that I encounter every day have experienced a lot of suffering, and they don't trust each other. They don't want to talk to each other. And so what we're doing there, what I feel that I'm able to do, is facilitate that discussion.
Well, Tobin, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Tobin Bradley, political advisor for the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq.
Well, the United States also hopes to broker national elections in Afghanistan this coming June. But as in Iraq, some administration officials have begun to express doubt about present timetables. We're joined now by Ahmed Rashid, a reporter for the Far Eastern Economic Review, who's been reporting on Afghanistan for more than 20 years. He joins us from Boulder, Colorado. And Ahmed, only 8% of eligible Afghan voters are registered to vote. Among women, the number's only 2%. Given that, are summer elections realistic? What's the rush here? Is President Hamid Karzai pushing this, or the U.S., or both?
Well, the U.S. has been the prime mover behind this rush to have elections by June, and it's largely been driven, I think, by the November elections in the U.S. President Bush wants to go to the American voters and say, well, Iraq may be a mess, but we've had a great election in Afghanistan. Now, you know, that's an agenda that's being set in Washington rather than being set in Kabul. Karzai himself is very keen for elections also because he doesn't want to appear to be one of these hangers-on to power. But this is a very divisive issue in the cabinet. Many ministers are against the elections. The Europeans are mostly against the elections, and they are the largest donors to Afghanistan. The United Nations itself is against the elections and says that voter registration can't take place. 10.5 million people have to be registered. And it's a slow process because of the security situation.
Given that U.S. officials have hinted, some U.S. officials have hinted that possibly delays could happen in Afghanistan, do you think that's a trial balloon to indicate that that is exactly what will happen?
I think what you're seeing now within the administration is a divide on this. I think you've got the realists and the more practical-minded officials trying to tell the media that, you know, things should be delayed. And they're trying to send a message to their more ideological bosses saying, you know, this can't be held and that this could backfire. The essential point is, I think, is that can you have a credible election which could be admitted to by the Afghan population that, yes, you know, at least 60 to 70% of the people took part and there was no intimidation, there was no major crisis over corruption or other things. And I think at the moment the feeling is that you can't have a credible election. And I think these officials are trying to send a message up the chain.
Ahmed Rashid, in a powerful and I'm afraid pretty dark piece you have in this week's New York Review of Books, you refer to something you call the U.S.'s warlord strategy. Can you tell me very briefly what that is and how that also perhaps makes it difficult, if not impossible, for elections?
Well, you know, right after the war ended against the Taliban and al-Qaeda, the U.S. funded and armed and backed the militias of the warlords who had supported them in the fight against al-Qaeda. And that policy has carried on until late last year and, of course, has been hugely detrimental because these militias have, in fact, become criminal gangs, intimidating the local population, pillaging, harassing, looting, robbing, and acting with total impunity. The Americans then dropped support for them, or at least stopped funding them, you know, over the last few months. But now there's another rush to rearm and refund these militias, because the American argument is that if we have elections, we're going to need these militias to keep the security. Well, the Afghans are saying that these militias are the cause of insecurity rather than keeping security. And it would be very foolhardy for the Americans to depend on these militias to maintain security for a June election. Yet another reason not to have elections in June.
Ahmed Rashid is a correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review. He joined us from Boulder, Colorado. Ahmed, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, a map of the world you don't have to fold. It's in cyberspace and on your cell phone.
And later, a study that shows women who regularly use antibiotics have an increased risk of developing breast cancer.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Map making is among the oldest of human technologies, way older than writing. Map is tablet from Babylon, thought to be more than 4,000 years old. Well, nowadays, maps are everywhere more than ever, even if you can't see them. That's because an invisible digital map now covers the entire world like a cloak. And our regular information technology commentator, David Weinberger, says that map will change our lives in ways both great and small. David, welcome.
Hi, Bill.
David, let's start with a vision of the not-so-distant future. You're walking up the street feeling a bit hungry. You come to a restaurant, but is it any good? You want to know. What do you do?
Well, what you need is a portable computer like a Palm Pilot,
mm-hmm.
or a cell phone, okay. Which is actually a portable computer. You need a wireless network, which increasingly is refining in cities and elsewhere. And then you need a body of material, which is the World Wide Web, if nothing else. So, yeah, so you take out your Palm Pilot, it's wirelessly connected, and you just search for the review. That's the simplest thing. It actually gets more interesting past that when that becomes an everyday occurrence. And not only can you look up the review, but you can leave a review.
How accessible is this right now?
There are getting to be networks now that are devoted to this idea. You can talk about the history of a place with somebody who knows about it. You can read the history of documents about it. You can enter into a conversation about the artwork around it or the architecture.
So the difference between what we're talking about now and the World Wide Web is that this is information you can get right where you stand.
Yes, and it's information about where you're standing or sitting.
Most of us have probably used sites like MapQuest to get to grandmother's house on Thanksgiving or whatever to get driving directions. How much more detailed is this digital map we talked about in our introduction that cloaks the entire world?
It's not that there's a single map that some government agency has produced. Rather, various localities are producing maps of different degrees of specificity depending upon the need.
I see. So we're talking about how all the different maps and catalogs of information can be sort of turned into a huge web or imagined or envisioned as that.
Yes, exactly. So the map that you need for traveling on the subway is actually, you want a greatly simplified one. Subway maps don't show generally the above ground streets. If you're going on a walking tour, you want a map that is highly detailed down to the storefront level. So maps are always tool dependent. They're always function dependent, and the degree of specificity depends on that.
So how good is the positioning information if you want it to be very detailed?
Well, that's one of the things that's gotten much better. GPS systems, global positioning systems, have gotten relatively cheap. They've gotten much better since the year 2000 because the government has let commercial providers get at much more specific information about where you are. So instead of 100 meters, they can tell where you are down to 10 meters and, in fact, down to 3 meters.
Now, the navigation systems that are in a lot of cars now, even in a lot of rental cars, how good are they? My limited experience with it indicates that they may be terrific, but I couldn't figure out how to make it work.
Well, one of the problems with stuff in cars is you don't have a keyboard, so sometimes the user interface lags the functionality. But my experience with them has been really, really good. I am terribly directionally challenged. They will talk you through the turns. They'll tell you 100 yards ahead of time.
They talk.
Oh, yeah. They say, turn coming up in 100 yards. They're really phenomenal. They depend upon receiving signals from 24 satellites that are always circling the Earth in order to position where you are, and that stuff works really well.
Can you go into an area in Montana somewhere, let alone New Jersey somewhere, where it blanks out for a while? Or?
No, the satellites are positioned so that there will always be enough of them visible. You need at least 3. You have more problem in cities because the signals bounce off of buildings, and that tends to throw off the timing that you need to get accuracy.
So it's getting better and better and more ubiquitous. Will it get more ubiquitous still, all this?
Yes, absolutely. The chip that you need to do the location finding is getting smaller and cheaper and lower power, and so this stuff is going to show up everywhere, especially in cell phones. In fact, there's a mandate called the Enhanced 911 Act from the FCC that says by the end of 2005, basically all cell phones have to be able to position themselves, know where they are within 50 to 100 meters.
Really?
So everybody who has a cell phone, the system is going to know where that cell phone is.
That brings to mind two things. Why, and is that Big Brother glaring over our shoulders or what?
The ostensible reason for it is to enable 911 calls to figure out exactly where you are so they can get you emergency help. There are two sides of the Big Brother part. One is, well, the government knows, and the second is that merchants know. So as you're walking down the street, they know that you need to have a message beamed at you because suits are on sale.
So you're telling me that because of an act of Congress, in the not-too-distant future, the government will be capable of knowing where I or David Weinberger is at any given moment in any given place?
The technology for doing that will be there. Whether the law will allow continuous monitoring is a different question.
Wow.
Cell phone companies already have to know roughly where you are because they have to route signals to the right cell tower, but that's a fairly broad radius.
Yeah. David, as someone who follows the cutting edge of this thing as closely as you do, what is your sense of it? Is it to the good, predominantly, this extraordinary new technology that you can barely keep up with the advances in? Or is there a dark side that really worries you about it, that sometimes you wake up in the middle of the night and say, I don't want Big Brother to know where I am all the time?
Well, both. Yeah, I do worry about that. But there's something actually I think really important going on that's, I think, positive, which is the Earth has always been the mute thing. It doesn't speak. It's silent. It's a rock. Now, for the first time, almost anywhere you go, as this global network expands, almost anywhere you go, you'll be able to hear what other people have said about the Earth. You'll be able to read the messages they've posted or left. You'll be able to enter into conversation with them. You'll be able to annotate space, as somebody calls it. Mm-hmm. That is a really different sense of what it means to be in a place, to know that you can always get information, opinions, views, artworks about this place and its history and the community around it.
David Weinberger, thanks very much.
Thank you.
David Weinberger is Here and Now's regular information technology commentator. For more, visit our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the gasoline additive MTBE was due to be phased out due to environmental concerns. The Bush administration has put the brakes on the phase out. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It's a finding that may disturb many women. Frequent use of antibiotics is associated with higher rates of breast cancer. A study published in today's Journal of the American Medical Association shows that the more antibiotic prescriptions a woman has filled, the higher her risk for breast cancer appears to be. Researchers are not saying that antibiotics cause cancer, but they do say the study illustrates at least a need for greater restraint when it comes to prescribing and taking antibiotics. Dr. John Potter is a researcher at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle and an author of the new study. And Dr. Potter, tell us, how many women did you study? And what doses of antibiotics are we talking about?
Okay, what we studied was a total of about 10,000 women. About 2,500, a little less, of those women had had breast cancer, and almost 8,000 had no history of breast cancer. And we asked the question, over the preceding basically couple of decades, was there a difference in the antibiotic use between those two groups? And then what we did was we looked at cumulative days of antibiotic use and the number of prescriptions that they had filled. And what we established was that the higher number of cumulative days or the higher number of prescriptions filled, whichever measure we used, was associated with an increased risk of breast cancer.
In fact, those who had more than 25 prescriptions over an average of 17 years were twice as likely to get breast cancer. And it reminds us that there was a study in 2000 of women in Finland under 50 who took antibiotics for urinary tract infections. That study also showed elevated risks, a reminder of how much women in particular might take antibiotics for things like urinary tract infections.
Indeed. That was the only previous study, and that had been restricted to just looking at antibiotics for urinary tract infections and had not taken the opportunity to look at cumulative days, duration, number of prescriptions, etc. They just simply used a yes-no kind of exposure.
What do you think these results indicate?
What is clear to me is that this is not a study on which to base medical decisions. It's not a study on which to base policy decisions. It's a study that draws attention to the fact that there is an association here between higher use and breast cancer risk. It doesn't tell us why yet, although we specifically asked the question, was there an association? And we did it because we were interested in some aspect of the biology and because of the previous Finnish study.
Mm. And you also point out that your results could be because women who take a lot of antibiotics might also have weaker immune systems, and that might also predispose them to breast cancer.
Right. Although that association is also not very well established at all. There is an association between certain kinds of cancer risk and a weakened immune system. Breast cancer hasn't been high on that list, but it still has to be taken into consideration when we're looking at these results.
Well, what message do women take away from your study? There are women who have to take antibiotics, as we mentioned, regularly.
At the moment, as I said, it's worth thinking, is there a good reason for taking the antibiotics that I'm taking? It reminds us that perhaps taking them for conditions that don't require antibiotics, particularly the common cold, which is almost always due to a virus. And it reminds us, too, that in relation to breast cancer itself, that regular screening with mammography is an important thing. After all, women are at high risk generally across the country. And even if this turns out to be a relationship we should be really concerned about, we do actually have methods for detecting the disease early and therefore producing much better outcomes than if it's detected late.
Hmm. John Potter, Director of the Division of Public Health Sciences at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle.
Is it dangerous to eat meat? Only one cow with mad cow disease has ever been found in the United States, so the chances of getting the human form of mad cow disease seem small. But every year, 300 Americans do die from a related brain disease called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, or CJD, which has been thought to occur spontaneously in humans. But now, Italian researchers have discovered a new form of mad cow disease in cattle that looks a lot like the spontaneous CJD found in humans. So what does this mean? Might human CJD originate from eating cattle after all? Joining us on the line is Dr. Michael Hansen. He's Senior Research Associate at Consumers Union. Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Doctor, how did researchers in Italy find this new strain? And would the strain have been found in the United States? Do we test the same way they do?
Well, first, Italy has a widespread testing program. They test all animals above the age of 24 months, and they found over 100 animals. So what they did is they said, we're going to look at the more carefully at the brains of 8 of these animals. And out of the 8 that they looked at, 2 of them appeared to be different. They appeared to be this new strain. And to answer your second question, no, we wouldn't have been able to find those in this country because we don't test all these animals like they do in Italy.
And significantly, the animals in Italy all looked healthy. Typically, when a cow has mad cow disease, they fall down. It's obvious that they're sick.
Yes, that's true. These animals weren't exhibiting signs of disease. And the other thing that's unusual with them is they were quite old. The 2 cows in Italy were 11 years old and 15 years old.
So what's the significance of this for someone who's going to go buy some hamburger this afternoon for dinner in the United States?
It's just another piece of information that suggests that some of the so-called sporadic CJD, which supposedly is happening at random, might indeed be connected to things that people are eating. So it raises a little bit more concern about the disease as a whole.
Doctor, if you're an official at the USDA, which does animal testing in this country, do you think you'd look at these results and maybe reconsider how we test our animals in this country, including the fact that we don't test animals typically who don't look sick?
I think we should learn from these tests, and I would hope that the USDA would learn the lesson that we do have to test far more animals in the U.S., and that some animals that appear healthy need to be tested as well, because it should be pointed out that almost two-thirds of the tests in Europe right now, the animals that are testing positive are animals that do not exhibit symptoms.
Doctor, if in further testing in Italy, researchers do find a link between the human CJD form of this and the new strain they've found in cattle, would that suggest to you that there are more infected cattle in the United States than we realize now?
If this is further confirmed in Italy, what it shows is that, yes, there could be multiple strains of CJD that could be connected with things people eat. So it would tell us that we would need to pay far more attention to sporadic CJD in this country. Perhaps we should make it a reportable disease.
Dr. Michael Hansen is Senior Research Associate at Consumers Union. He spoke to us from Yonkers, New York. Thanks, Doctor.
Thank you.
Still to come, Beyond the New World Symphony. We'll hear some of the work scheduled to be performed to mark the 100th anniversary of the death of Dvorak.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Heating oil and natural gas prices are unusually high this winter, and a lot of people are turning to a more traditional form of heat, wood. The interest has sparked a boom year for New Hampshire's firewood industry, but it may also have caused a firewood shortage. Rachel Dornhelm from WBUR has this report.
Most of New Hampshire, 84%, is forest. It's an unlikely state to face a firewood shortage, but that's what residents there are dealing with this winter. That's a tractor jumping one cord of firewood, the industry's standard measure. Hillsborough County Forester John New says a cord is 128 cubic feet of wood.
That's about what a horse or an oxen could pull through the woods out to the farmstead.
Newt says a lot about burning wood for heat seems rustic.
So it's bulky, it's heavy to use, but on the other hand, if you've got a cord of wood in the backyard ready to go, you know it gives you a self-assurance, and it may be cheaper than fuel oil if it gets up to more than $1.50 a gallon.
Fuel oil prices have threatened to reach that point. While 1 in 10 New Hampshire households regularly rely on firewood for their heat, this winter half of New Hampshire residents are using wood for supplemental warmth. And they're looking for local suppliers.
Because it's such a bulky item to transport, a cord of wood weighs about 2 tons. It takes up a lot of space. And so it doesn't lend itself to easy transportation as oil and gas and other commodities might. So most of the firewood is indeed sold locally and used locally.
Newt credits the bad economy for the region's renewed interest in wood. He also says instability in oil-producing countries has made wood attractive to state residents. In the last 2 years, the price of a cord of wood has shot up from $150 to $250. Most homeowners need about 3 cords to get through the winter. New Hampshire Agriculture Commissioner Steve Taylor says the price spike has revived a firewood industry that almost disappeared a decade ago.
When you pushed the price up, you had people come back into the business, and we had started to have loggers get more interested in cutting the log length wood for firewood, and you had people who process firewood sort of get back at it.
But not enough people got back at logging and processing to meet current demand. Kevin Morse owns CVS Firewood. He says firewood producers have to buy freshly cut logs far in advance to make sure they dry enough for customers to burn.
A lot of the people that get into it aren't able to go out and buy that much wood and sit on it for that much time, to sell a year and a half down the road.
The reopening of a paper mill in northern New Hampshire has only exacerbated the shortage. The mill pays a premium for just the kind of small dry lumber that supplies the firewood market. Still, Kevin Naylor, manager of a wood stove shop, says for many firewood users, burning wood is an emotional and an economic choice. Whereas fossil fuel users,
they don't puff up with pride when they say, I heat my house with oil or I heat my house with electricity. You do have those. I guess you do have that kind of mentality around a wood stove. They kind of feel like they're separate from the people that are relying on the oil and fuel provided by somebody else.
That's why Naylor says he expects firewood users will continue to pay the higher prices. From Concord, New Hampshire, I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Here and Now.
Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
That's a selection from Antonín Dvořák's Symphony No. 9, which is much better known as the New World Symphony, the Czech composer's most famous work. But Dvořák is much more than this symphony and more than his other best-known work, his cello concerto. Dvořák composed at least 100 other pieces, including operas and string quartets and much more. Well, this year, music lovers around the globe commemorate the 100th anniversary of Dvořák's death. And all his music will be in the air. For a preview, we're joined now by Ellen Pfeiffer, Here and Now's classical music connoisseur. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Bill.
Dvořák, son of a butcher who wanted to be a composer, and what a composer he became. Tell us about him.
His father was indeed a butcher, but his father was also an amateur musician, as many people were in those days and in that part of the world, Bohemia. He wasn't a prodigy, and he didn't intend to become a composer right away, but he studied the organ, he studied viola, and performed a lot in bands and all the other music-making activities that went on in a small town.
His most famous work, as we mentioned, the New World Symphony, but he was very much a Czech patriot.
Oh, yes, he was. Well, anybody who knows anything about Czech history knows that the Czech lands were the subject of endless subjugation and warfare and internal warfare, too, a lot of religious war. And in the 19th century, the Czechs were finally, even though they were under the Habsburg rule, were finally beginning to exert some strong nationalist feelings, and Dvořák was no different.
How does that find its way into the music?
Well, there were a couple of prominent idioms that appear over and over again in his music. One's called the Dumka and the other the Furiant. And the Dumka is a folk ballad and has a somewhat melancholy atmosphere. So here's the slow movement from the piano quintet, and it'll give you an idea.
The melancholy slow movement from Dvořák's piano quintet, an example of the Dumka.
The Dumka.
The Dumka, a kind of
folk ballad.
Folk ballad in Bohemia. Earlier, though, you mentioned Furiant. What's that?
Well, that's a kind of dance, and it usually has contrasting rhythms. Three beats against two beats is very common. Here's an example from the Scherzo from the Seventh Symphony.
Dvořák, that's from his Seventh Symphony, something of a bridge from the Romantics to the modern era. He lived till 1904, into the 20th century, just before music began to be radicalized, if you will, by Stravinsky and so on.
Yes, yes. He was very much a creature of his time. He was very much influenced by Brahms and his predecessor, Smetana.
He wrote a lot of operas. I don't think of Dvořák as a composer of operas.
No, we don't know of him as a composer of operas, but he wrote 11 of them, including one, if you really want to be technical about it, 12, because he wrote one twice. They were almost all flops, except for the last couple, mainly because they had terrible librettos. Dvořák was not much of a literary man and didn't have access, I guess, to really good librettists. But he's best known as Ruzalka, his last, which is based on a Hans Christian Andersen tale, we all know it, The Little Mermaid. But this setting is a tragedy, and the
character who we know from the Disney cartoon, Ariel, in this case Rusalka, does not live happily ever after. She does not win her prince, but it is a very enchanting piece with a lot of beautifully detailed color. There's a wonderful aria for Rusalka called The Song of the Moon, and here she's hoping that the moon will find her prince and tell him that she loves him. And this is an example sung by Renee Fleming.
Opera Rusalka, sung by Renee Fleming.
It's just gorgeous, and the whole opera is beautiful. I just don't understand why more productions aren't done of it.
Also for voice, he wrote liturgical music even.
Yes, he did. Not too many, but he was a very devout Catholic, and on several occasions he turned to liturgical music, and he wrote a Stabat Mater for orchestra, chorus, and soloists. Around the time that he had some tragedy in his life, he lost his first three children to smallpox and poisoning, and he was very fond of children. He did go on and have six more happily, but this piece reflects, I think, some of the sadness of that event.
Jacques Stabat Mater. He spent, famously, time in America.
Yes, he did. It's a very curious story. He was here from 1892 to 1895. He was recruited by an American wife of a great entrepreneur, Mrs. Jeanette Thurber, to come and head her National Conservatory in New York. He had a very attractive position there, and he came, and people were crazy about him, and he soaked up a lot of the indigenous musical influences here, the music of blacks and Indians. But he didn't use any of these actual tunes in his music, but allowed them to sort of influence what he wrote. And the New World Symphony is a sort of greetings from the New World.
He wrote it in New York, the New
he
World
He wrote
Symphony?
It in New York. He also wrote the Cello Concerto. He was only here for about 3 years. He spent one memorable summer in Spillville, Iowa, which was a very small town but had a large Czech population, and he had an idyllic time there with his whole family. So he enjoyed much of America, but not particularly New York City.
Well, Ellen, having had a little oral glimpse of some lesser-known Dvorak, this 100th year anniversary of his death, maybe we should go out on the very, very well-known Ninth Symphony from the New World.
Yes. This is the finale, and I think it's just a wonderful example of Dvorak's energy, elan, and his great bohemian spirit.
Ellen Pfeiffer, thanks.
My pleasure, Bill.
As always, Here and Now's classical music connoisseur, Ellen Pfeiffer. For more information on some of this year's musical celebrations of composer Antonín Dvořák, check out our website at here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@HERE-NOW.ORG.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.